Nice new building that I haven't seen yet. So yes, I'll tell you about supersymmetry, and these are some plots from the talk. You know, I will use this screen to point at things, so maybe even this one, because I can't reach, and I didn't get a laser pointer that I can see. Anyway, the talk will be about supersymmetry, and these are some plots. Two of them don't appear in the talk, actually, but it doesn't matter. So let me start with presenting my collaborators. These are labeled both in chronological order and number of publications. The main one is Mithat Unsal, who is now at San Francisco State and is moving to North Carolina. Mohammed Anber, a postdoc in Toronto. Thomas Schaefer, faculty at North Carolina State. And there are two graduate students, one in Toronto, one in Germany, and two undergraduates, actually. You'll see what they did from Toronto. So this is, of course, the list of papers that I want to talk about. And obviously, I will not cover them all. This talk actually is going to be largely in pictures. So hopefully the experts among you are not terribly bored. And some things that would take some time to explain, I will just declare, and you will have to believe me. But I'll try to make them plausible. So where does this title and abstract came from? I used to work on supersymmetry with a view towards phenomenology. And now that the first run of the LHC is over, we still have variants of weak scale supersymmetry, but they kind of look not very nice. There is natural supersymmetry, complessed, split, favorable, etc. And we are looking forward to either finding them or not at the LHC. But that's not what I'm going to talk about as far as supersymmetry goes. I will discuss another application of supersymmetry, not one that will be seen at the LHC. It is less direct, less mainstream, and more recent. And it has to do in using supersymmetry to learn about non-supersymmetric field theories. And the main message of my talk is that we have realized that studies of supersymmetric gauge theories from the late 90s, when properly interpreted, lead to insights which are relevant outside of the supersymmetric realm. So I will illustrate this nature, this so-called insightful nature of supersymmetry by two examples. They have to do with the microscopic description of the thermal deconfinement transition. We'll see that a host of strange topological molecules are the major players in the confinement-deconfinement dynamics. And we'll also see interesting connections emerge between topology, various condensed matter, in quotation mark, gases of electric and magnetic charges, and attempts to make sense of the divergent perturbation series. About the last part, I will talk very little, but it's something that is being very actively pursued by various people at the moment. So this is more or less the three topics I will discuss. First, I'll tell you about the confinement. So this is just to make sure everybody's on the same page. Then I'll discuss what I mean by topological. And mostly, I will consider this conjecture about continuity between some supersymmetric theory and thermal Young Mills. Then I'll talk about thermal gases of electric and magnetic charges. And then I'll conclude. And my main goal is to tell you what are these three things, what do they have in common, and how did SUSY help in these topics. So first, deconfinement. What is deconfinement and how we study it? Well, first of all, deconfinement means no confinement, or the lack of it. Confinement happens in QCD, the theory of strong interactions, formulated in terms of quarks and gluons and discovered in the 70s. A major feature of QCD, which makes it very different from electrodynamics, is anti-screening. Just to remind ourselves what happens in electrodynamics, we have screening of charges. So as we go to larger distances, the coupling becomes smaller, and at a scale that you observe of order larger than the electron's quantum wavelength, it's 1/137, measured at the scale of the Z mass, 100 GeV or 10^-18 meter, it's about 1/128. So if you have a dipole field of charges from your first year physics textbook, if you take one to infinity, you end up with a Coulomb-like field. And this field is Coulomb-like at long distances. The situation in QCD is quite the opposite. The coupling in QCD has a very different behavior with the energy scale or the inverse distance scales. The coupling is small at short distances, 0.1 at about the Z boson mass. It rises to about 0.3 at about 2 GeV. And then it becomes of order 1, which means the theory enters a non-perturbative regime at a scale about 1 Fermi, 10^-15 meter, or about a little bit less than a GeV. As a result of that, the field looks Coulombic only if you are at distances shorter than the strong scale. The strong scale will appear in my talk in several places, and it will be denoted exactly like that, just to sort of remind you of that. So So a distance is shorter than the strong scale. If you zoom in here, it looks Coulombic, but if you go far away, you see that the chromoelectric flux between two color sources has a very different behavior than the one in QED. In particular, it forms this flux tube, and it doesn't extend to infinity like a filter for dipole. And so if you take one of these quarks to infinity, what you end up with is not an isolated quark, but you end up with an infinite chromoelectric flux tube, a thin chromoelectric flux tube which stretches between the two quarks. The energy of that cube, the energy of the chromoelectric field in that cube, is linearly grows with the distance between these two color sources. And the coefficient sigma has the dimensions of energy per unit length. In particle physics, units is 1 GeV squared divided by h bar c. If you convert it to normal units, it's 10 to the 6 newtons. It's a constant force. So if you remember that 1 newton is the force of the Earth exerts on 100 grams, you really understand what strong interaction means in this sense. You know, the force is really strong. And there is a million-dollar question, both colloquially and literally, of how the Gruss and quarks, the fundamental fields of QCD, give rise to such configurations. As far as I know, there is only one monograph on this subject produced so far, and it's actually not bad. It gives an overview of various existing approaches to this problem, from center vortices, abelian projection, color superconductivity, to IDS CFT. So it's quite broad. So what happens when quarks and gluons are heated up, because this is my subject? It is believed that what happens is that this string tends to melt and dissociate, and the quarks and gluons actually start propagating freely. This is known nowadays indirectly from experiments such as the relativistic heavy ion collider, which collides a relativistic heavy nuclei. They have so many nucleons that, and they have so much energy that when they collide, it is believed that quark-gluon plasma is found for a short time. This is a typical picture from the star detector trick. It looks like a mess, but studying these productions of the reaction, people can infer properties of the quark-gluon plasma. In the early universe, this also would have been relevant if you go back in time to 10 to the minus 10 seconds after the Big Bang, when the temperature is 10 to the 12 Kelvin or 100 MeV. Also, it is believed that there has been a phase transition between a hadronic matter phase, when there are neutrons and protons, to a quark and gluon phase. So why does this deconfinement occur? I'll give you a picture and an estimate. So the picture will consist of assuming that Yang-Mills theory confines. Therefore, it is a theory of strings, so the theory of chromoelectric fluxes. And the energy of a flux tube of length L is proportional to its length, so it grows like linearly with the length and is proportional to the string tension. And as you heat up the system, there are more and more states available to a string of length L. If you try to estimate the states, you can adopt a naive model that the string consists of bits that live on a lattice. And if you start at a given point and try to estimate in how many ways you can go a length L away, you see that at every junction, you can go in 2d minus 1 directions if you don't allow backtracking. So the number of states go like some number times the number of links or bits of strings. And if we assume that this length of the little bits of strings is related to the string tension, we get an estimate for the entropy that it grows like the log of a constant times the length in units of the string tension. And so if you look at the free energy of a string of length L, we clearly see that if the temperature is large enough, long strings are preferred because the entropy dominates. And in particular, the partition function will diverge at the temperature of order square root of the string tension of order 100 MeV. This means that there should be a phase transition. The entropy dominates, the string melts or condenses, and confinement is lost. So this is a pretty simple model. And despite its success to predicting the string tension, the critical temperature, this is a picture. It's quite far from a theory, from quantum chromodynamics. This picture becomes a theory, but in a very specific model, in a very specific regime. So how do people actually study the confinements? Mostly, they actually do experiments. They do real experiments. Nowadays, at the LHC, there is an ALICE detector devoted to the collision of relativistic heavy ion at LHC energies. And this is a typical picture from ALICE. And again, by studying the products, you try to infer, for example, hydrodynamic properties of the plasma, the equation of state, etc. So this is one kind of experiment about which I won't have that much to say. The other kind of experiment is numerical. What you can do with QCD, since it's a well-formulated theory of quarks and gluons, is to define the Feynman path integral by discretizing space-time. This means that you assume that space-time, Euclidean space-time, is a grid. And the theory can be well formulated thanks to the work of many people in the past. And therefore, you can ask the computer to do the calculation of complicated things. You have to worry about making sure that the discretization doesn't spoil your result, don't spoil your results, so you have to be at the critical point, but people have learned how to do that. And the output of that is a lattice calculation of the quark-antiquark potential. For example, this is the potential in units of Fermi. I told you the strong scale was roughly one Fermi or something like that. And this is the potential between two static quarks in Purang-Mills theory as a function of the distance in Fermi. And you see that there is a change from logarithmic to linear behavior. This is at zero temperature at a scale about half a Fermi. On the other hand, when the system is heated up to, in this case, I guess this line is above TC, you see that this linear rise doesn't occur. Okay? So this is the difference between confining and the liberated or deconfined phase. So in this situation, you can ask, is there a place, a need, or an opportunity for any kind of analytical work? So I told you that the kind of ideas people have in this field involve pictures. This was the thing two slides ago. They can also involve models. Models, what I call models, are, in the best of circumstances, some kind of toy theories, or you can call them effective theories, which are designed, in the best of cases, to feed some subset of data, either from lattice field theory or from experiment. And when dealing with such massive stuff, such as the deconfinement transition, which occurs at temperatures of order the strong scale, these models have their place. But there is dangers, and the dangers are if they're taken too seriously. Very often, these characterizations that I really like, voodoo QCD applies. I heard this from Kenyon Trilligator, but apparently it belongs to BJ. And this is really an approach to studying QCD when you never know if you're right until you're confirmed by some other means, be it experiments or lattice simulation or something like that. So very often, these are on shaky ground. So what I call a theory, of course, lattice QCD fits. It's a well-defined theory for first principles. However, to use it in the continuum limit, unfortunately, requires numerics. And so the question I want to address is, are there any theoretically controlled first principle calculations that allow analytic studies? And the answer is that there are only a few of those. I will list them for you. None of them captures all the features of real QCD. And you may ask, why do we care? I will give you my answer to that. But first, I want to recall some facts about thermal theories. So the thermal partition function of any theory is the trace of e to the minus beta h for a quantum theory without fermions. So if we formulate this theory in terms of the path integral, we can think of it as formulated in Euclidean R3 cross S1, where S1 is now a spatial circle, Euclidean circle, of sides of the inverse temperature, which I will also always call L. So when L is large, we are at low temperature, and we are in the hadronic confined phase. When L is small, we are in the high temperature quark gluon plasma phase. And in between, at L of order lambda inverse, of order Fermi, there is this strong scale where the transition is believed to happen. So how do we probe for this transition? The way we probe to this transition is by studying the potential between static quark probes. How do we insert a quark in the vacuum of the theory? Well, an infinitely massive quark, the only thing it does is its world line just propagates in time. Remember, this circle is Euclidean time. And it doesn't wiggle because the quark is massive, infinitely massive. So it just goes around a circle at a constant position in R3, and that's it. And the only thing it does, it creates gluons through its coupling via the path ordered exponential. This operator, if you take its trace, is gauge invariant, and it's called the Wilson or Polyakov loop. And if you insert two such operators, one going this way, the other going the other way at some distance far apart, and calculate their correlator using this partition function, the result can be interpreted as the exponential of the negative of the potential between the quarks divided by the temperature. As I told you, in the confined phase, the potential is linear. So V of x is sigma x. And when x goes to infinity, you get 0. Therefore, by clustering in the confined phase, the expectation value of this operator is 0. On the other hand, in the deconfined phase, the potential is Coulombic or screen Coulombic, because there is screening in the plasma. And this exponential goes to 1. The factor in the exponent goes to 0 at infinity, and so the exponential goes to 1. And so the expectation value, again, by clustering is non-zero in the deconfined phase. So it seems like we have ourselves a way to distinguish a confined from a deconfined phase. And indeed, if we consider SUN theories without fundamentals, we can associate deconfinement with a change of symmetry realization. The symmetry is called center symmetry, is Zn for SUN. It doesn't really matter where it comes from, but the point is, once you compactify a theory on a circle, you always get this extra symmetry. It's a little bit of a strange symmetry, but it only acts non-trivially on these non-local observables, such as the Polyakov loop. You can think of it as a gauge transform periodic up to the center of the gauge group, but not necessarily so. So this operator is multiplied by nth root of unity under this symmetry transformation. And obviously, if the operator has an expectation value, the symmetry is unbroken. And if it has an expectation value, the symmetry is broken. And this is exactly what people find in lattice simulations, in Pure-Yang-Mills theory, calculating this order parameter. So this is some lattice simulation. I don't know the parameters of it, but you see that they get zero. And then as they increase the temperature, this expectation value becomes non-zero. And there is a sharp-looking transition. The behavior at asymptotically high temperatures, much larger than the Strong scale, has been understood, the behavior of this quantity, not all behavior of the theory, the behavior of this quantity, has been understood for over 30 years due to the work of Gross, Pisarsky, and Yaffe. What they realized is that for the purpose of calculating the expectation value of the Polyakov loop, a high temperature perturbation theory is good enough. And they calculated the one loop perturbative potential for this quantity. And because the temperature is much higher than the Strong scale in this regime, corrections are small. So they're suppressed by the coupling at the scale of the temperature. So it's not immediately obvious what this potential implies. But just trust me, it does imply that trace omega approaches 1 when to minimize this potential. If you don't believe perturbative calculations even in high temperature, you can turn to the lattice. This is a recent lattice simulation calculating the same thing. So on the axis is the potential for the quantity, which I will define now. It will be somewhat important for me, so I will use it. So this operator whose trace you're taking is a unitary operator. So for the case of SU2, it has two eigenvalues whose product is 1. And this is what is plotted here is the free energy as a function of this angle nu. And you see that this is minimized at nu equals 0 or 1. So what this means is that the two eigenvalues are on top of each other. And in fact, this shape of the potential is exactly the one. If you plot this function, it's some polylogarithm or something like that. It's exactly this. So we understand at least the behavior of this quantity at asymptotically high temperatures. Gross, Pisarsky, and Yaffe already in 1981 said that they started at asymptotically high temperature. They realized that the theory should deconfine. The expectation value of this order parameter should be non-zero. They said it is hardly surprising that we cannot explore the transition as the temperature is lowered from the deconfined to the confined phase using solely weakly coupling techniques. Of course not. Not surprising, because you end up going through the Strong coupling scale. Despite the fact that we cannot do this in QCD, it is of interest to find examples where one can study deconfinement by reliable analytical techniques. So this is my answers on the questions from a few slides ago. My first answer is we do it because we can. Okay, we are theoretical physicists. We are having fun. It is great fun. And I will try to convince you that what we find is beautiful. Okay, if that's not enough, if you're applying for a grant, you need probably more reasons. So another reason is that understanding, in any case when you can have some understanding of an analytically calculable regime, I think it's always good, even though you don't know from the beginning what you will learn. It is likely to give insight into important aspects of the physics and, in general, into how quantum field theory works. And the final reason is that if you have a calculable regime where you understand the validity and its corrections, you can try to push it to the borders of its validity or even beyond. People do that all the time. And the resulting models, because you leave analytically controllable part of the theory, can be compared with the lattice or with experiment. And there has been work on that recently. So what are these ways allowing us to study the confinement analytically? Several ways have been found in the past 30 years. Not too many, so I can list them pretty quickly. The one that you have probably all heard about is gauge gravity duality. In gauge gravity duality, it is believed that semi-classical string theory, or supergravity, classical supergravity, provides a weak coupling description of strongly coupled gauge theory in the large n, large toothed coupling limit. And if that's the case, then you should be able to use this to also study the confinement in such theories, if they have the confinement transitions. And at least Witten was the first one to point out this and to use gauge gravity duality to study the confinement. And this kind of analysis has actually turned out to be very useful macroscopically, especially out of equilibrium quantities or near equilibrium quantities have been very, not very easy, but have been made computable by using this gauge gravity duality. The disadvantage of this approach is that it comes with extra baggage. And the extra baggage within the limit of validity of the approach is that there are no non-decoupling Kaluza-Klein modes in supergravity. There is no asymptotic freedom. And in many cases, the microscopic connection is obscure. Another approach, which involves purely field theory, probably fewer of you know, is due to Aroni and company. They started with just pure Young-Mills gauge theory, and they studied pure thermal Young-Mills theory, so the space-time is the space-time has a thermal circle, and they compactified the spatial part of space on a trisphere. This, of course, this is a non-thermal by definition, and if you take this trisphere to be smaller than the one Fermi, if we use those units, then you know that the Coulomb law should hold, and you should be able to use perturbation theory, and this is what they did. What happens is at small S3, there is a weak coupling metric model, and the physics of the transition, which they find, is a van der Montre repulsion of eigenvalues in the matrix model at low temperatures, and a perturbative attraction of Polyakov loop eigenvalues that I showed you a few slides ago, due to Gross-Pissarz Kenyaf, essentially the same. They worked on this for several years because computing the properties of the transition turned out to be quite non-trivial. The disadvantage of that approach is that, of course, you don't have a non-compact space, and thermodynamic limit means that the transition is only an infinite n transition. It's a Gross-Witten type transition. These authors rejected the possibility of finding a weak coupling transition at infinite volume, infinite spatial volume. But such a description has been found at some price. So the cases where you can have the confinement transition and the theoretical control where analytically involve, of course, a thermal circle because, well, you're studying the confinement, but they also involve compactifying only part of space, not the entire part of space, but only one circle. So this S1 is a non-thermal circle, and its size acts as a control parameter to study the theory. And the theories that I will discuss in this setup I call QCD adjoint. These are essentially Young-Mills theories with many massless adjoint Weyl fermions. You may ask, why are these theories interesting? There is various reasons. One reason is that they're very close to supersymmetric theory. The theory with one adjoint is supersymmetric. The one with four adjoints is almost n equal 4 without the scalars. And in general, if you take the gauge group to be SON of some appropriate kind, then you can relate the Lagrangian limit of these theories to the particular Lagrangian limit of QCD with fundamental quarks. You can use something called the Lagrangian or Yantifold equivalence, which can be proven in field theory. So this is another motivation. I won't discuss it. So what happens there is that if you keep the size of this circle small, you can map the four-dimensional thermal gauge theory to a 2D spin system. And this map is not just a map saying that the transition should be in some universality class, therefore there should be a spin model that describes it. It's a much more detailed map. You can map the parameters of the model to the parameters of the gauge theory and in great detail. And it's interesting that the models that appear are related to some condensed matter systems, as you will see on some late slide of mine. For example, there is a theory of the melting of triangular lattices in two dimensions due to David Nelson, and it really involves such a model for SU3. So of course, there are disadvantages. The theory the dynamics is really abelian, and this parameter L to have theoretical control, the size of the non-thermal circle, has to be kept smaller than infinity. Nonetheless, I find these systems fascinating, and I can't stop working on them. The reason is that these are very strange things. These are two-dimensional gases of electric and magnetically charged particles. They have Coulomb and dual Coulomb interactions. They have Aronoff-Bohm interactions. They inherit the symmetries of the respective four-dimensional gauge theory, all kinds of symmetries. And you can define Hooft operators and Wilson operators in them. And they show the confinement transition. We understand far from all about these theories, even just in this simplified setup on the confinement. Even more interestingly, in the process of unraveling this map, the supersymmetry played a crucial role. I will explain that later, and these theories will be the subject of the last 10 minutes of my talk. Instead, I will begin the talk by talking a different setup, also involving a special compactification. So I consider supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory star, which I will define in a little bit, compactified on a circle, on a spatial circle. And this circle is a priori non-thermal, but we'll see that it also can get a thermal interpretation. So let me give you some definitions. The first definition is what is super Yang-Mills, or SIM. It is Yang-Mills with a massless quark in the triplet of SU2. I'll just discuss SU2. This is also known as Gay-Jinnah. It's what the LHC was looking for. And the fields in this theory are gauge bosons and Gay-Jinnahs, so or normal four-dimensional gauge bosons and Weyl fermions. This theory has a Z4 chiral symmetry. It will play some role in what follows. Super Yang-Mills star is the same thing, but I add a mass for the quark. This is called the Gay-Jinnah mass. And this Gay-Jinnah mass obviously breaks supersymmetry explicitly. It also breaks the Z4 chiral symmetry. It breaks supersymmetry because the masses of the gauge boson and Gay-Jinnahs are not equal anymore. So that's the theory we'll study. We'll study this theory compactified on R3 cross S1. The size of S1 is L. And there will be periodic boundary conditions for the Gay-Jinnah. What this means is that these are supersymmetric, non-thermal boundary conditions. Remember that for thermal systems with fermions, you have to take the fermions antiperiodic. So in the limit when the Gay-Jinnah mass is finite, this is strictly speaking not a thermal system. There are only two parameters to vary if you study this theory, the size of the circle and the mass of the Gay-Jinnah. And the theory is asymptotically free. It has a strong scale, lambda. So there are two dimensionless parameters, the ratio of the mass to lambda and the ratio of L to lambda. In addition, because this theory is compactified on a circle, it acquires a center symmetry, Z2 center symmetry, which will play an important role. Z2 is the center of SU2. So if we study the phases of this theory, therefore, we can draw a two-dimensional phase diagram. One is the mass, and the other is the size of the circle in units of the strong scale. So when the mass is zero, this is simply super Yang-Mills, compactified on R3 cross S1. And this has been the subject of a lot of papers, starting from Seiberg and Witten in 1996, Ronnie and company, Davis and company. And these people studied this theory using the language of supersymmetry. They used the language of superpotentials, scalar potentials, etc. I will not use this language in this talk. Of course, to do the calculations that we do, we use this language. But it's not so important for the talk. Important relevant details of the instanton calculation were actually given only recently. I was surprised, but that's the case. So the supersymmetry work that I refer to is really these first three papers. So let me start with the limit when the mass of the Gay-Jinnah is very large. When I take the mass of the Gay-Jinnah to infinity, I end up with thermal Yang-Mills theory, right? Because I end up with a purely bosonic theory. And this bosonic theory, compactified to Euclidean R3 cross S1, I can call a thermal theory. There is no problem with that at all. I can decide that S1 is the Euclidean time direction. So this is thermal Yang-Mills. And from lattice simulations, we know that it has a thermal transition at a critical size of order equals 1 over Tc, of order the strong scale. So we know that there is a thermal deconfinement transition. The theory confines, and it's center symmetric at large sizes. And it's deconfined and is center broken at small sizes and large temperatures. So this phase diagram, by continuity, you expect it to extend. This line you expect to extend in the bulk. Then we go to the other line, the other end. Oops. Then we go to the other end. I told you that when the mass is zero, this is supersymmetric Yang-Mills. Supersymmetric Yang-Mills on R3 cross S1 as a function of L has no phase transition because this partition function that I'm studying is simply the Witten index. However, when you add a small Gay-Jinnah mass, what you find is that there is a phase transition associated with the breaking of the center symmetry along this circle. I told you that the symmetry on the circle always acquires this symmetry whose order parameter is the Wilson loop around the compact direction. And so here there is a phase transition. It's a quantum phase transition because this is not a thermal theory associated with Z2 breaking. What's interesting about this quantum phase transition, that in the limit of small mass and the size of the circle, it can be studied in a theoretically controlled manner. And one finds that there is a variety of novel topological excitations and various perturbative contributions which yield competing effects, and they result in this transition. So from this diagram, we know that there is a transition here, and we know that there is a transition here. And so we conjecture that there is a continuous connection between this transition and this transition. I should emphasize that this plot is from the paper. I should have made a plot where this line is dotted, because we don't know how it behaves, strictly speaking, right? And we cannot prove it. It's a a complicated task, but I will present some evidence for that. The mechanism behind the transition here is universal. I will talk about it later. It is valid for all gauge groups that we have studied, whether or not they have a center. And it will become clear why I'm talking about a phase transition without the center in a moment. The order of the transition here is always the same as the order in the corresponding Yang-Mills theory. And various qualitative properties were first predicted by calculations here. In particular, the theta dependence of TC and the strength of the transition were first predicted here, and later, lattice people in the last year have learned how to measure them here. They find the same qualitative behavior. So before telling you how this part of the phase diagram comes about and all the interesting players that occur, I want to list the evidence in support of continuity. I told you that the two transitions are in the same universality class. Mostly they're actually first order, but anyway, it's Zn breaking for Sun. The transition is always of the same order here and here. The transition is first order for n bigger than 2, and this is as seen on the lattice. For the group G2, which doesn't have a center, is also first order. And in this case, the transition is not associated with symmetry breaking. It's very common in first order discontinuous transitions that that's the case. And I just want to show you something which is kind of interesting. So this is a lattice study of the G2 theory. And this is a histogram of the distribution of the Polyakov loop, the trace of the Polyakov loop. This is low temperature. You see that the trace is small, but non-zero. This is high temperature. The trace is non-zero. And near TC, you see two peaks of the distribution. One is the low temperature phase, and the other is the high temperature phase. And you see that the peaks jump from a small negative value to a large positive value. Well, guess what? When we do our calculation here, we find exactly the same thing. We find that we have the jump between a small negative value to a large positive value. So it's kind of amusing. If you add massive fundamental quarks, the transition becomes a crossover. They break the center symmetry, as seen on the lattice. The qualitative dependence that was first observed here is the theta angle dependence. So in pure Yang-Mills theory, you can introduce this topological theta angle. Perturbative quantities don't feel it. And what was found in the small simulation, in the small L calculations here, is that the critical temperature decreases as one increases theta, and the discontinuity of the Polyakov loop increases. So both these things were later observed in simulations. Simulating theories on the lattice with non-zero theta angle is non-trivial, but people are learning how to do this in non-trivial ways lately. So the results agree with this. So now I'm done with listing the evidence. I want to tell you how this came about. So what is the role of supersymmetry? Supersymmetry plays quite a bit of role of this. Supersymmetry, first of all, the theory is weakly coupled if you take L small enough. And the reason for that is that the theory abelianizes. It's not just that small L corresponds to high energy scales, and therefore, by asymptotic coupling, the freedom is small. No, because even at small L, you have other three non-compact directions. You can go to large distances, and there can be strong coupling. So the theory actually abelianizes in a very interesting way. And that ensures that it's weakly coupled. Having a weakly coupled theory at small L and abelianized allows us to have calculable non-perturbative effects. These effects are roughly of order e to the minus 1 over g squared. So they're non-analytic in the coupling. At the same time, of course, the coupling is small, and we have calculable perturbative effects. These perturbative effects, of course, are of order g squared. And if we had in a non-supersymmetric theory, if we had a quantity which has contributions both from perturbative and non-perturbative effects at small coupling, you would never have a chance of consistently balancing this with this, because non-perturbative contribution would always be down. However, in supersymmetry, we have this extra parameter, the mass, the Gugino mass, and you know that the perturbative effects vanish when you take the Gugino mass to zero. So this extra parameter allows us to have a fight between perturbative and non-perturbative contributions in a way which you understand. And the major players in these fights are various monopole instantons and twisted monopole instantons. I will pictorially explain what those are. Those were, in a later slide, those were first discovered by studying instantons and solitons on compactified D-brains in N=4 theory. But they actually also are solutions of even pure Yang-Mills theory, compactified on a circle. So not only the displayer, these are the major players, but also what is important, these players can form various topological molecules. And one kind of molecule was found by Unsal, and another part was found by the two of us later. So let me try to tell you a little bit about these dynamics in pictures. So I tell you that the small L theory is a billion. SU2 breaks down to U1. The scale of the breaking is 1 over L. And because L is small, it's a quite large scale. So the theory is weakly coupled and can be described semi-classically. During this breaking, because the theory only has adjoint fields, there are no light charge states left. So all the light states are not charged on the gauge group. And the relevant bosonic fields are simply the gauge field in the unbroken U1 of SU2. Remember, we had a gauge field and a gaugino. There was nothing else in the theory. The gauge field has a component in the compact direction, and it has a component in 3 dimensions. The component in the compact direction I will call phi in what follows. It won't appear in too many slides, but it will appear a few times. And it will be normalized so that if phi is non-zero, this means that the trace of the Polyakov loop along the compact direction, which, remember, depended on A4, is non-zero. If phi is zero, the trace of omega is zero. So phi is an order parameter for the center symmetry that we are looking for. This 3-dimensional gauge field, at large distances, the dynamics is 3-dimensional. I can dualize into a scalar. In 3 dimensions, the photon only has 1 polarization, so I can do that. The dual to the gauge field is called the dual photon. It also can be interpreted as potential for magnetic charge, which will play a role for us. So in this theory, if we don't worry about any non-perturbative effects, we are done. This is a very boring theory. In fact, these fields are free. There is also a fermion, but I don't show it. So what we need to do is to study non-perturbative effects. And almost all dynamics in this theory is due to non-perturbative objects. The statement that I want to make is that the vacuum of the theory can be thought of as a 3-dimensional dilute gas of various kinds of molecules. These molecules interact via long-range forces, and they interact, these long-range forces are due to the exchange of the dual photon, exchange of the scalar phi, and fermion zero modes hopping. So depending on your background, this may sound like a horribly strange statement that the vacuum of the theory can be thought of as a dilute 3-dimensional gas of some sort. So let me try to explain that using a quantum mechanical example. So here is a quantum mechanical example of a double well potential. And suppose I'm interested in calculating the amplitude for a particle in Euclidean time to just stay here. And if I'm in the semi-classical regime, when h bar goes to 0, the path integral that represents this amplitude can be represented as a sum over saddle points. Saddle points are all classical trajectory that go from here to here in a given time. Every saddle point contributes e to the minus s, and there is some determinant of some fluctuations, which we'll ignore. And so what are these saddle points? You go to Euclidean time. The equations of motion correspond to moving in the inverted potential, because the I flips the sign of the two-time derivatives. So you need to study trajectories in this potential. And trajectories that go stay here basically are of two kinds. One kind is the particle just stays here. Another kind is it goes back and forth once, it goes back and forth twice, etc. So a typical trajectory that contributes is one where the particle goes from A to minus A and back, and then goes from A to minus A and back, and etc., etc. And you have to sum over all saddle points with their weights, etc. So you see that the saddle points are just characterized by these places in Euclidean time where the particle jumps. So, and you have to sum over all possible distributions of these places, you know, these kinks, if you wish. And so you can think of that as the partition function, a grand partition function of a one-dimensional gas of these tunneling events, because the only thing that matters is the time when the particle tunneled from left to right and back. So this is the sense in which I can think of as the ground state of the theory, or the partition function, as being a dilute one-dimensional gas of tunneling events, which are also called instantons. So we go to the field theory, we do the same thing. We have the vacuum-to-vacuum transition amplitude in some large Euclidean time, and we want to study that in the semi-classical approximation, where h bar goes to 0. So this is where you just have to believe me, OK? So the question is, what are the finite action saddle points of this integral? So the claim is that the finite action saddle points of this integral are simply related to what in 4 dimensions, in 3 plus 1 dimensional Minkowski space-time, is known as Tuve-Polyakov monopoles. So Tuve-Polyakov monopoles are classical solutions in 4-dimensional gauge theory, SU2 broken down to U1. And they have the property that they have some core, which will not be of interest to us. And there is magnetic field, which radially emanates from the core. Okay, so it's a monopole. It's a magnetic monopole. The word line of this static solution in 4-dimensional Minkowski space-time is simply a straight line that extends from plus to minus infinity. And that's it. So it turns out that this theory on the circle has the same kind of solutions, and they are obtained by taking this four-dimensional solution and taking its world line to be Euclidean around this circle. So these solutions are instantons because they are localized in time. Remember, time is along this direction. This is a spatial direction. They have finite action because this extent is finite. And more interestingly, there is actually two kinds of these solutions of lowest action that will matter for us. There is actually an infinite number of them, but we are working at small l, so we'll just keep the leading two. And the other one you can think of as a solution which is not translationally invariant around the S1, but it has a twist which I have represented graphically by a ribbon here. It doesn't make sense, but it really indicates the fact that the solution depends on S1. They're twisted by a center symmetry transformations. So these are the two basic solutions, and their properties are that this solution has positive magnetic charge, this solution has negative magnetic charge, so their magnetic fields are opposite. And the two solutions combined make up a four-dimensional instanton, which is something I won't discuss. Okay? So they're instanton quarks. But there is even more. You know, you believe me about the solutions, but now this is a theory with fermions. So these solutions represent some tunneling events. They are saddle points of this path integral, so they represent tunneling events. But it turns out that because they're massless fermions in the theory, these solutions don't just represent tunneling events from the vacuum to the vacuum, they actually necessarily create two fermions, two massless fermions out of the vacuum. And this is represented by these arrows. So both solutions, both the positive charge one and the negative charge one, create two massless fermions from the vacuum. They're anti-solutions. They have opposite magnetic charge. And the fermions that create, you can think of the opposite chirality fermions. So these are the basic building blocks in this theory, which allow us to study the non-perturbative structure of the vacuum in the semi-classical approximation. So these solutions themselves don't correspond to vacuum tunneling because they create fermions. So what we need to do is to make something out of them. So these are the four kinds of tunneling events that we will use. And we need to make some form of correlated events which do not involve creation of fermions. And to leading order in the semi-classical approximation, just taking the smallest axon solution, there is two kinds of such things. If you look at this, these are the four basic building blocks. And you want to build something that doesn't involve fermions creation. So what you need to do is to, what you need to do is to connect the arrows so that an arrow that goes out comes in. These two you cannot connect because a combination of these two is really just a four-dimensional instanton, and it creates four fermions. So it's not a vacuum tunneling event. But a combination of these two does not create fermion, and a combination of these two does not create fermions. So the kind of molecules that occur, modulo complex conjugation, are two kinds. There is the molecule, which you can think of as a bound state, or correlated tunneling event of these BPS monopoles with the KK star monopoles. I can connect the arrows into this object. And there is another kind which connects these two and also these two. So this is an object of this kind. These events can be represented in various ways. They can be represented by the so-called Tuft operators, or Tuft vertices. You can think of those Tuft vertices in two different ways. One way to think is that this is a local vertex. This is just the Tuft suppression, the action. The action of this solution is, roughly speaking, twice the action of the constituent. There is some correction, but it's small. It's calculable. So you know, if you were in quantum mechanics, you would just write e to the minus s for every instanton. Okay? However, these guys have long-range fields. You see, this guy has a magnetic charge too. So it emanates a long-range field. And somehow, you have to indicate that in the partition function. And you indicate that by putting this exponential of the twice the dual photon with an I. And this says that this object creates two units of magnetic charge. So this is called a Tuft vertex. And the insertion of that vertex in the partition function corresponds to inserting this saddle point that corresponds to this tunneling event. That's one way of thinking about them. If you resum these saddle points, then this becomes a term in the action generated by a dilute gas of these objects. So that's another way of thinking about them. Similarly, this object has no magnetic charge, but it actually has two units of scalar charge. And so I can give you a picture of the vacuum now. The vacuum is this dilute gas. There are monopole instantons. And then there are these molecules of these two types. This type of molecule, these are called magnetic bions. And there are also, these are called neutral bands because they don't carry magnetic charge. Whoops. So the magnetic monopoles are the one with the arrows. The magnetic bions carry magnetic charge too. And the neutral bions, which on this plot are not distinguished, they carry scalar charge too. So the role of these molecules in the vacuum of this theory is different. The magnetic bions generate a mass gap for the dual photon. This also means that they make this theory confined, and they also break the discrete chiral symmetry. I won't dwell too much on the discrete chiral symmetry. The neutral bion events, on the other hand, they carry scalar or modulus charge too, and they have to do with the stabilization of the Z2 center symmetry. These are especially interesting from this recent point of view of the relation between topological molecules and renormal ones. I will just have one slide in the end of my talk about this. But this was discussed by Argyris and Unsal, and it's very tantalizing. It's not greatly understood in four-dimensional field theory, but there are indications that there is some relation between these things. So let me try to explain this pictorially. So I'm still studying the supersymmetric case. The mass is zero. And the physics of this gas of magnetic bions, so let me concentrate on the magnetic bions, is the physics of a Debye screening in three dimensions. There is a mass gap and confinement in the theory. So we think of the gas of magnetic bion, which is one component of the vacuum functional of this theory, as a gas of these molecules that have charge 2, you know, plus and minus. And it's a grand partition function. They can appear with any number in any amount. And so, and including these molecules in the partition function means that you're summing over non-perturbative subtle point, just like in quantum mechanics. So if I probe the vacuum in this theory without summing over non-perturbative subtle point, again, I can probe by inserting two infinitely heavy quarks, a quark and an antiquark. So remember that the time here is in my R3 direction. So I insert one wire and another wire. Okay. And remember that in the bulk, this theory is abelian. So the only long-range fields are the magnetic fields. So you can really think of inserting these quark operators as insertion of currents. This current creates a magnetic field, which in between the points in this direction outside of the board. And of course, you know how two currents interact from electrodynamics. It's just a logarithmic interaction per unit length. And that's, of course, the 2D Coulomb potential, right? Because this is two space, one time dimension. So the potential between infinitely static quarks, if you then don't take into account the non-perturbative subtle points, is just Coulombic. On the other hand, you have to take, if you take into account the fact that these two currents are inserted in a gas of magnetically charged particles, then you immediately realize that there will be screening. Because so you have a magnetic field, and you're trying to create a magnetic field perpendicular to this plane. And this is inserted in a plasma of magnetic charges. So of course, the magnetic charges, by electrostatic analogy, will try to screen this magnetic field. So there will be a dipole layer. This is a cross-section viewed from the side. There will be a dipole layer of negative and positive magnetic bions, which will screen the magnetic field. And therefore, the flux of magnetic field between these two charges will be confined in a line between them on this surface. You can think of this dipole sheet as the string world sheet of this confining string in this theory. And so this changes the potential from logarithmic to linear. And of course, what I'm telling you now is the Polyakov mechanism of confinement due to monopole condensation, 30 plus years old. the condensation word here just appears to the fact that the vacuum is a gas of many monopoles. So there is a non-trivial density of monopoles, which screen magnetic fields. The novelty in this mechanism, first discussed by Mithat, is that the objects which do the screening are not monopole instantons. These are composite objects. These objects don't exist if the theory is formulated on R3, because both this object and this object, remember, those were twisted. If you take the 3D limit with fixed three-dimensional gauge coupling, they have infinite action. So this theory does not confine in the 3D limit. So this is a theory which confines in the locally 4D limit, but not in the strict 3D limit. And so the mechanism, I just discussed the mechanism by which these magnetic bions induce a mass gap. You can see that also from this formal interpretation of the Hooft vertices. I told you that these bions were resummed. Give rise to this term in the Lagrangian. These bions, the anti-bions when resummed, give rise to this term, the Lagrangian. And if you combine these two, obviously this is a cosine, and it is a mass term for this dual photon. So similarly, the other bions, the neutral bions, they generate a potential for this modulus scalar. Remember, there were two bosonic fields in this theory. And the potential is a cosh of 2 phi. And so that minimum is minimized at 0. So the expectation value of phi is at 0. And so these guys stabilize center symmetry. This is why we call them center stabilizing bions. Usually, if you're a supersymmetric guy, I don't know how many are in the audience, you can recognize the sum of these four terms as the result for the bosonic potential from the total superpotential. That's really what happens for SU2. Our interest here is the role of neutral bions. The reason is that we are interested in the behavior of the center Z2 symmetry, not the chiral one, because we are interested in the theory at non-zero mass. This is the theory that relates to pure Young-Mills theory. So what happens when I add a mass term is two things. The first thing that happens is that because the fermions are massless, massive, the monopole instanton, the tunneling due to monopole instantons, which necessarily involve production of fermions, now does not involve production of fermions because the fermions are massive. So there are extra contributions to the vacuum-to-vacuum amplitude due to monopole instantons. These are denoted by axes. These are called mass insertions. So there are extra non-perturbative contributions. And of course, the mass breaks supersymmetry, so there are extra perturbative contributions, like Gross-Pisarsky-Yaffe. But those are small because the mass is small. So the real fight now, determining the fate of the Z2 center symmetry, which I told you at m equals 0 is unbroken, is between the contributions of monopole instantons and magnetic bion molecules. These contribute when the mass is small, and they actually like to break center symmetry. So this is the main fight. The contribution of perturbation theory is actually suppressed in the calculable regime. And, and because there is a fight between controllable non-perturbative contributions between two objects, we can actually study the properties of the transition in a reliable way. And what happens is that if you increase the value of mass, so the contributions of this monopole instanton become more and more important, then they dominate, and eventually the center symmetry breaks as you increase the mass at fixed L. The transition happens when this parameter becomes order 1. This is a dimensionless parameter, combination of the two that I gave you. The transition is second order for SU2 and first order for SU3 and SUN. And if we are to engage in what people call models, we can say, well, for our model, this is number A is equal to 8 when the mass and L are small. Now, if I assume that this continues to large mass and also L of order lambda, if I assume that the quarks decouple at a mass of order 5 lambda, as is known from lattice QCD and quarks, then I can plug this saturation value here, and then I have myself a prediction that the critical value of L is lambda. But of course, that's not a particularly surprising result. So instead of formula, this is what happens for SU3. These are two plots of the potential for the deviation of the eigenvalues of omega from the center symmetric value. In SU3, there are two eigenvalues. At low temperatures, both of them are at the center symmetric value. At high temperatures, there is a first order transition to a Z3 breaking minimum. So it's interesting that the same object that I discussed can also be identified in pure thermal Young-Mills theory. The reason is that in pure Young-Mills theory, near the confinement, the eigenvalues of the Wilson line are not necessarily not on top of each other. So there is some breaking of SU2. And people like to build models based on these topological objects. What is lost, unfortunately, there is the theoretical control. Nevertheless, instanton liquid type models of the deconfinement transition can be considered, and these molecular contributions that we discussed can be incorporated. Shuryak and collaborators, they claim some success, but I believe that the lattice data they're basing it on is quite modest, I would say. So the moral is that one can build models and or compare small L calculations with the lattice. Eventually, the entire phase diagram M versus L can be studied on the computer. So I told you that there is a quantum center breaking transition, which we gave evidence is continuously connected to thermal deconfinement. So we can compute quantities here, and we can study the connection. Eventually, we should be able to fill this diagram. The transition is driven by topological molecules in a way that is well understood. And some of them are quite strange. And indeed, they appear, they appear needed to cancel ambiguities in the divergences of perturbation theory. And Argyris and Dunn and Unsal, they are trying to make the claim that this could be used to define the theory. We'll see. So all of this was non-thermal. This was a quantum phase transition. This is a thermal phase transition. And we have a continuous connection. The advantage here is calculability and understanding of the dynamics. And the last 10 minutes I will spend of explaining that we can also have a controllable deconfinement transition in the thermal setting. And this will be very quick. I think I have enough time. So this involves number 3 on my list of calculable studies of deconfinement, compactification of essentially the same gauge theories on a non-thermal and a thermal circle. This theory is Young-Mills with many massless adjoint well fermions. So it could be super Young-Mills, or it could be also just Young-Mills with more than one well fermions, which is non-supersymmetric. And it turns out that adjoint QCD theories on R3 cross S1 with periodic boundary condition on the non-thermal circles retain many features of super Young-Mills. And let's consider this theory first, the QCD adjoint on R3 cross S1 with periodic fermions, and then we'll add temperature. So I'll go back to my super Young-Mills slide and I'll apply this operator, just cross everything that doesn't apply. It's actually very easy because the two properties that I listed before still apply. The small L theory abelianizes, but slightly for a different reason. It abelianizes because of the Gross-Pisarsky-Jaffe type of potential with periodic fermions. No need to discuss that, just trust me. This is the same feature as in super Young-Mills. As a result, the scalar modulus, which was a light field required by supersymmetry, is not there anymore. And so on the other hand, the monopole instantons in this abelian theory are there. The magnetic bions are there. The only thing that's changed is the strength of their binding because there are more fermions that are responsible for the binding of these molecules. Everything else is the same. These neutral bias molecules are present, but they play no role in the thermal deconfinement transition. So the T equals zero physics is absolutely the same as in supersymmetry. There are magnetic bions, there is a mass gap, and there is confinement due to the mechanism I explained before. I repeat that again here, that confinement is due to composite molecular objects. So next, we want to study the non-zero temperature dynamics. So we take a spatial circle and a thermal circle. So this is my T equals zero theory. Now I want to consider the thermal theory. So in the thermal theory, near the deconfinement transition, the theory actually becomes approximately two-dimensional. Roughly, this is because the transition is thermal and not a quantum. I'll give you a picture in a little bit. Now, when you have a thermal theory, remember, this theory was SU2 broken down to U1, so there are W bosons whose mass is 1 over L, which are electrically charged particles under the unbroken U1. And now in the thermal theory, there is no way to say they're heavy, they don't appear. They will appear proportional to the Boltzmann factor. So these W bosons will be thermally excited. These are genuine particles, electrically charged particles. The magnetic bions are still there. They will form a two-dimensional gas of magnetic charges. These are pseudoparticles because they're localized in time. But when you reduce to two dimensions, both the electric and magnetic charges appear as particles in this plasma. So the picture is that we have a two-dimensional gas where we have our magnetic bions, and then we have W bosons. So we have electric and magnetic charges. Here is another picture of the same thing. Here is the thermal time directions. These are the magnetic bions. They are localized in time, so there can be anywhere in the bulk. There's instantons. And there is the W bosons, which are really almost straight world lines because the temperatures relevant for the transitions are much less than the mass of the W bosons, so they really don't wiggle much. I've wiggled them too much here. They're really straight lines of charged particles. What this picture doesn't represent correctly is the fact that the typical distance between the bions for the temperatures relevant for the transition are much larger than the size of the thermal circle. So you can really project that picture onto the two-dimensional plane. I just didn't have space enough. I would have had to draw a bion here and a bion here, and I would have run out of space. So the partition function then becomes that of a classical, the word classical is not quite appropriate, classical two-dimensional gas of electrically and magnetically charged particles. They carry all kinds of interactions. The W bosons, of course, have Coulomb interactions. These have dual Coulomb interactions. And the bions and the W bosons have a Ronov-Bohm interactions because these are monopoles. So they create magnetic fields, which the W bosons feel. So this is the three-dimensional picture, but we really, near the deconfinement transition, project that onto the two-dimensional plane. So these are not just words. Due to weak coupling, the reduction of the partition function to the gas can be justified, and corrections can be estimated and computed. So I had to have a slide with the partition function, OK? So this is for SUNC. This two-dimensional thermal partition function reduces to this glorious formula. So So let me explain what it is. This is a grand partition function of a two-dimensional gas. You sum over all kinds of all possible distributions of electrically and magnetically charged particles. They come with their fugacities, which are determined by the properties of the gauge theory. Magnetic bions have fugacity. Electric bions have fugacity. You sum over all distributions. You integrate over all positions, as you would in any Stat-Mech class. And then you include interactions. The W bosons have an electric Coulomb interaction, which is logarithmic in the two dimensions. And its strength is determined by proportionally to the gauge coupling. This is the relevant strength. The charges of the W bosons are given by the affine roots of the Lie algebra. The magnetic bions are magnetically charged particles. Their charges are given by the differences of the affine roots. And their strength of their coupling is more or less opposite to that of the W bosons. It goes like 1 over g squared. And then there is the Aronoff-Bohm interaction, which, of course, has no coupling. It's purely topological. And you study, when you project the interaction of Ws with the monopole and all its images in the thermal direction, you find that this is really proportional to the polar angle of the vector between the electric and magnetic charge. And this has an I, so calling this partition function classical, it's a matter of words. So this is the partition function, and, well, it's glorious. And the question is, how do you study it, and what do you expect? This partition function has interesting properties. By the way, it's valid in some region near the phase transition. It's not valid too much outside, but this can be estimated. It turns out that for SU2 and SU3, it has a high-low T duality, also known as Cramer's-Valier duality. It's not immediately obvious for here, but it really does. And the fact that it's only SU2 and SU3, it has to do with the structure of magnetic bions. So the duality interchanges kappa with 4 over kappa, roughly, and interchanges electric and magnetic charges and fugacities with fugacities. So then, for SU2 and SU3, we have a natural candidate for the critical temperature, the self-dual point. I'm almost done, by the way. And so what you expect, if you remember your physics of two-dimensional Coulomb gases, these are the electric particles. Their coupling goes like 1 over T. So at low temperature, the coupling is very large. And so you expect that the creation of these particles will be suppressed. On the other hand, the magnetic particles have coupling proportional to the temperature. And you, at low temperature, you expect that they will appear a lot. So the physics is that they're magnetic particles at low temperatures. They cause confinement of electric charges. And they're magnetic electric particles at high temperature. They cause the confinement of magnetic charges. And this is a simulation. This is actually for super young mills, so it's not quite symmetric between electric and magnetic. But you see, these are the density of magnetic particles. These are the density of electric particles. This is a Coulomb gas simulation due to my smart undergraduates. So I showed you one way how we can study the details of the transition. It's actually quite non-trivial in general. So one way is to do Monte Carlo of the Coulomb gas, which is a little bit problematic because of the I. But it, unless you focus really on the critical region, it mostly can be done. These models can also be mapped to spin models. I will show you a map a little bit later, which don't have a sign problem and can be studied easily. For SU2, luckily, it turns out that the properties of the transition can be studied analytically, because the one way to study the to look for critical points is to look for fixed points of the renormalization group equations of this Coulomb gas. This Coulomb gas is defined at some scale associated with the gauge theory, and then we study how it renormalizes. And it turns out that there is a fixed line extends into weak couplings. Our fugacities are weak, so we do an expansion in fugacity, and we have a fixed point. And we can calculate some of the critical exponents. So the, what we know, what we have found out so far about the order of the transition is that it's continuous for SU2 as in 4 dimensions. For SU3 and SU4 is first order, also as in 4 dimensions. Most answers were obtained in the spin model picture, but using the affine XY model. So let me tell you a little bit about the model, show you the movie, and then I'll be done. So the XY model is a, we call it an affine XY model. They're XY spins. These are U1 spins, just the angular variables living on the lattice. They're rank G of them. In this representation, they represent the dual photons. The vortices of the spin model are the electrically charged particles, the W boson. Makes a lot of sense, because the vortices are charged with respect to the duals of the dual photons. That's the original photons. And the magnetic bions appear as an external field breaking the symmetry of the spin model. And the physics in this representation, that vortices are confined at low temperatures. They're almost non-present. They appear very rarely. On the other hand, the magnetic bions proliferate. They break the discrete chiral symmetry and they confine electric charges. At high temperature, we have many vortices. They break the center symmetry and the external charges are confined. So I'll show you a movie due to my students. It's actually showing already. And this is a movie, however, in a different duality frame. You can play these games here as well. So the arrows represent, I'll run it again. The arrows represent the XY spins on this picture. And the XY spins, the small fluctuations of the XY spin are really the photon excitations in the U1. So if you see randomly fluctuating arrows, this means that there is a small correlation length because things are non-correlated. This means that there is a mass gap. On the other hand, if you see ordered arrows, this signifies center symmetry breaking because the correlator, inserting an operator that creates an arrow is roughly speaking the insertion of a Wilson loop in this theory. And so there is center symmetry breaking. And the vortices are actually the magnetic bias in this picture. And you see that we actually ran to high temperature where things are ordered and there are almost no vortices. Occasionally you see a vortex pair appearing, but it's very close. Whereas at low temperature, you see that it's exactly the opposite. The photon is disordered, the electric fluctuations are disordered, but the vortices appear quite voluminously. And so, one final slide for theories. Maybe somebody can give me some idea or some hint. This also shows the map to four-dimensional parameters. The same physics of this dual Coulomb gas, magnetic and electric Coulomb gas, can be described by the same phase transition, can be described as the quantum phase transition of a one-dimensional system with a somewhat strange Hamiltonian. It involves a scalar field, phi, but it also involves the dual of the scalar field. So dx theta is really the conjugate momentum to phi. So this is a one-dimensional system. But theta itself appears in the Lagrangian. So in two dimensions, this will be the dual field to phi. And the commutation relation of the two is that it's a Heaviside theta function. So this is the Hamiltonian. And I have shown how the fugacities appear in terms of high energy parameters, the couplings, et cetera. As I said, for nc equals 2 and 3, this is self-dual. It can be seen by manipulating the phi and the theta. For SU2, at the self-dual point, this model is actually a secretly a free field theory. For SU3, I have no idea what it is. And what bugs me in this game is that still, even though we can identify the non-perturbative excitations which are responsible for confinement, studying the transition still, even in this framework, requires numerics. It would be nice to understand why for SU2 the transition was continuous, but for SU3 and 4 it appears not. And maybe this is possible in these models, but I don't know enough about two-dimensional physics to tell. So I'm done. What did I tell you? I tell you about how supersymmetry can, directly or otherwise, help in finding calculable realizations of deconfinement. This is a complicated, strongly coupled problem. It's non-exact, non-BPS, non-protected, non-holomorphic, non-anything. The two examples I discussed was super young Mills with gauge mass on R3 cos S1. I argued that the quantum phase transition there appears continuously related to thermal deconfinement transition. The other thing I argued was that you can study QCD adjoint, including super young Mills, this is a subset of this, on R2 cross S1, where one S1 is thermal, the other is non-thermal. And there the deconfinement maps the physics near the transition maps the theory into a simple gas of electric and magnetic particles. And even this is not so easy to study. You could ask non-equilibrium questions from this, but then you would really have to study this, where you have W bosons and magnetic bions. You have to study the dynamics of this theory. So this is probably something for the future. In both cases, various properties of the transition agree with known four-dimensional lattice results. And as far as some applications of this stuff, well, one application is that we pointed out many erroneous assumptions and statements in existing models of deconfinement using topology. I'm not mentioning any names, partially because some of the people are not with us anymore. There is some new effort in model building trying to incorporate these topological excitations and molecules, the so-called instanton monopole liquid. There is a model of the QCD vacuum at zero temperature called the instanton liquid model. It is difficult to derive from first principles in QCD, but it describes correctly some properties. For example, some chiral symmetry breaking properties and some correlator of the lowest lying variance are actually reasonably well described. It's due to Shurek and collaborators in the 80s. So these people are working now on instanton monopole liquids, and they claim success. We'll see. And finally, there is Reddy's work. I showed you Reddy's work in pure Young Mills, confirming predictions or feature found in the supersymmetric case at small m and l. There is also activity studying the phases of adjoint QCD on a spatial circle, including super Young Mills. So you can ask, what's next? We had a lot of fun. Well, obviously, we can have more fun. One natural step is to extend all these studies to all gauge groups. That hasn't been done yet. And part of the reason is that it's tantalizing that so many properties appear to match between the calculable regime and the thermal Young-Mills regime. And there have been simulations of Young-Mills theories other than the ones I mentioned. We haven't studied the corresponding super Young-Mills star realization. So it's interesting to see whether there is a match in those cases too. Of course, the very interesting question, if there is always a match, as to why that is. I don't know the answer. I'll suggest something later, but it's quite wild. We also found novel topological excitations stabilizing center symmetry. These are these neutral bions. They appear related to renormalons, or rather, they are required to cancel renormalons ambiguities of the perturbative series. So this was suggested by Argyris and Unzal first. And there is a beautiful, so this works in quantum mechanics, is very well understood. There is a beautiful paper of Dunn and Unsal and others in the CP1 model, CPN model, and in the principal chiral model in two dimensions, also compactified on a circle, where a very similar story develops, and data can show that indeed the renormalon ambiguity is canceled by the contributions of these molecules. So a very interesting question is how general this is, and how far can this resurgence idea be pushed in quantum field theory? So this word hasn't appeared yet in my talk, but it is really stimulated by developments in quantum mechanics. So in quantum mechanics, Zhang Justin and Yanchura a few years ago, actually starting in the 70s, but latest papers are from the early 2000s, they argued that the semi-classical series, so this series that I showed you in the beginning, the sum over all saddle points in the quantum mechanics double well example, including all exponentially small corrections, all the power law corrections, and all the logarithmic corrections, can actually be made sense of. And what I mean by this is the following. So we have a perturbation series, for example, for the ground state energy. there are various instanton sectors labeled by k. K equals 0 is perturbation theory. Higher k are non-perturbative contribution, increasing numbers of instanton anti-instanton pairs in this language. Every instanton sector comes with perturbation theory around it. And perturbation theory in the 0 instanton sector is non-Borel summable in this case. Perturbation theory in the 1 instanton sector is non-Borel summable. None of these perturbation series are Borel summable. In addition, there are these so-called Zhang-Justin locks, which come from, actually, they're really important. They come from integration over quasi-zero modes over when you calculate these molecules. Now, what Zhang-Justin argued is that this series can actually be made sense of, by a generalization of Borel summation called Borel-Lekauer summations. And it can be, quote unquote, resumed into something that they call an exact semi-classical result. So it's some finite expression whose expansion exactly generates this series. And the very interesting question that I still don't think we know the answer in quantum mechanics is whether this property continues to strong coupling. So if you have this exact semi-classical result, is it actually exact strong coupling? Unsal tells me that the answer appears to be yes, but I haven't seen anything, you know, written in black and white. And of course, an even more interesting question is whether that applies to quantum field theory. So the dream of Argyris, Unsal, and collaborators is that maybe in the cases where we believe a continuous connection between super Young-Mills in the semi-classical regime and, say, thermal Young-Mills exists, the similar continuation to strong coupling of the fact that the semi-classical series can be made of is the deep reason why we see this agreement. Obviously, this is very wild. I don't know. I hope you appreciate that. It's a very long-term story, and I'll stop here.
So we're running a bit late, but we can have a few questions. So first, are there any students who have questions? Okay. Other people that have questions?
I'm an outsider, but when you go from SUSY to Yang-Mills theory, you say that there is a continuous chain.
Oh, we don't know that. It's a conjecture.
Conjecture, okay. Yeah. So that means somehow the fermionic partners,
yeah,
which are getting heavy, they decouple themselves.
Absolutely,
affecting,
yeah,
the bosonic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And also, is the beginning state gapful?
Yeah, 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 it is.
So
yeah,
you go from one gapful to another gapful.
It's gap, yeah, it's gap.
The conjecture
gap
is there's no
it's gap
point.
It's gap, yeah, it's gap. Both states are gapped. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted.
So this is kind of a two-part question. So I'm trying to understand your picture of the QCD vacuum, if this was a good analogy, is still kind of like condensative monopoles, but now they're bionic monopoles,
yeah,
as opposed to,
yeah, yeah,
but the mechanism for confinement would be the same. It would,
yeah,
be the dual,
yeah, yeah,
the dual of what happens in a superconductor.
Absolutely, yes.
And so the second part, you called these molecules, but if you said it, I missed it. Is there some sort of interaction? What binds these molecules?
Yeah.
It just looked like you arbitrarily picked two and
molecule. No, no, okay. No. So there is a magnetic charge, plus and minus, but there is also fermion zero mode exchange. And what happens is that the potential between them is something like 1 over R. It's actually L over R. So this is a doubly charged molecule. So there is a repulsion due to the magnetic interaction. So this is the potential. This is repulsion. And it's really G squared, the four-dimensional gauge coupling at that scale. So there is a repulsion, but the fermion, the exchange of the fermions between these guys generate attraction, which is proportional to the number of fermions times log R. So it really looks like this. And this is the size of the molecule, if you wish. And the size is of order G squared over L, forgetting about factors of NF. So yes, there is a well-defined size.
And what was L?
Object.
Was L the temperature, or was L?
Sorry. This is at zero temperature. This is zero temperature.
So L is what? This compact.
L is the size of the spatial circle. Yes.
So what happens as L goes to infinity?
Oh, that's the million-dollar question. I didn't claim that price. Your question is what happens when you take L to infinity?
Yes.
Problem is that I'll draw another picture. I'll draw it here, actually. So we have these molecules. The size of each constituent is of order L. The separation between them is of order L over G squared. So it's, sorry, the size of the bound state is of order L over G squared. So it's actually L over G squared. The dimensions is wrong. The distance between molecules is exponentially large, with some number. So at small g, all the scales are separated. When I take L, if I keep the lambda QCD fixed, the coupling becomes strong. So I take L large, the coupling becomes strong. All these scales collapse on top of each other. So the system becomes non-tractable. So we have not solved the old infrared embarrassment problem of QCD. Okay? So L is a control parameter which allows you to control the scale separation. You know, we can do this kind of physics when there is a scale separation. Also, when the coupling becomes large, then why are you just considering two atomic molecules? These are the lowest action. But when the action becomes large, you can have things like that. You know, why not? And they're equally important. You see, so this thing breaks down. I wish I could tell you what the QCD vacuum is.
Thanks.